Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags, and over the next 30 minutes, I'll bring you the latest headlines from South Africa and around the globe. Whether you're tuning in live or catching the podcast later, please stay with us for in-depth conversations with leading business minds, political influencers, and key newsmakers. It's everything you need to stay informed, quick, sharp, and straight to the point. It's Tuesday, the 15th of October. Coming up on the program, Build One South Africa leader Musi Maimane slams the GNU for its bloated cabinet. His words, we'll talk to him in just a moment. How inflation is affecting the price of your morning brew. Transnet speaks on the next steps in revitalizing Durban's container terminal in conversation with the utility's chairman. And storm clouds are brewing over a proposed housing estate in a Plettenberg Bay green corridor. Bosa leader Musi Maimane is again talking about reducing the size of the cabinet to ensure what he says is better accountability and governance. But in the delicate web of coalition government, is this at all possible? Musi Maimane, a warm welcome. And why do you believe this is necessary and why now?
First and foremost, I think that South Africa is in a very difficult fiscal position. We're running out of resources to fund teachers, to fund policing, to fund healthcare. And what's happened under the GNU is that effectively we've bloated the executive and have had to deploy additional resources towards that, which is money that was taken from all the other services I've already mentioned. Secondly, I think the bigger the cabinet becomes, the more cumbersome decision-making becomes. It becomes ceremonial and more protocol-driven rather than, in fact, a nimble, able team to deliver. And lastly, I just think that in the main, other than the resource conversation and all of that, all it's done is that when there's 70% of the parties who are in Parliament, part of the GNU, it limits the process of accountability and puts everybody in the executive, which means that the true winners then become members of the executive and the people get left behind.
What choice did the president have apart from extending the size of his cabinet, given that he had to form this grand coalition?
I think more than anything, the first immediate decision to have made would have been to scrap all deputy ministers. That would have at least signaled to the general public that, yes, we have to expand cabinet, but we don't have to add all of these deputies to accommodate political patronage. That would have been almost, if you like, a sense of symbolizing to people that as we cut at national departments, it makes sense for provinces to do likewise and for municipalities to eradicate any wasteful expenditure. So the principle is not about the government of national unity. It's about the fact that in certain ministries, there are even two deputy ministers, in which universe, when you find out what they in fact do, no one can articulate that, let alone for the deputy minister themselves to say what their contribution is to the collective cabinet.
Musi Maimane, some critics might turn around and say this is just sour grapes as far as Build One South Africa is concerned because you don't have a seat at the big table.
No, it's not at all. I'm privileged enough to chair the Standing Committee on Appropriations. And so wearing that hat, I have to look at whether the resources of this country are spent on the right priorities and whether they are being given to the benefit of all citizens. And what I'm seeing at the moment is that we're making special adjustments for an extended cabinet. The second issue is we made a conscious decision not to be part of the government of national unity for this exact purpose, which was to hold the government constructively accountable. An opposition that says to itself, how do we come up with alternatives to go forward? And then thirdly, I have been consistent about the size of cabinet. Even if I was in cabinet, I would still make the case to say it can become cumbersome, it can become clumsy if you've got too many people around the table trying to make a decision. It's almost typically, how many politicians do you need to change a light bulb? And I'm worried that this cabinet is asking for too many.
How many politicians does it take?
I would argue, if we look at the finance cluster, or you look at even, for example, the economics cluster, the fewer would be better. To have a ministry of even small businesses, trade and industry, finance, add labor, and then add a number of ministries in that space, means that economic accountability can never be felt, because ultimately decisions are being passed on from one ministry to the next, etc. And so my view is that if you actually want efficacy in the economy, leave the Ministry of Finance to be in charge of the macroeconomic climate and policy, and allow the presidency to lead and eradicate many of these nebulous ministries where ultimately we talk about the Ministry of Small Businesses, yet there are small businesses are suffering. We talk about the Ministry of Labor, yet when you look around, unemployment numbers are going up and labor centers are not functional. So to me, the more departments you put, it's just more staffing, more people coming on to serve the minister, and it doesn't serve the public.
Let's look at the numbers if we can. You say that money has been taken from other priorities in order to fund this cabinet operation. But in the bigger picture, this is a negligible amount, surely.
It is not. In essence, when you then streamline all of these departments and you don't actually even align staff allocation relative to how many to the budget of the ministry. For example, why should the Ministry of Sport, for argument's sake, which has a fairly low budget, have the same staff complement as the Ministry of Finance or the Ministry of Health or the Education, which have some of the highest budgets? It tells you that there's a mismatch in that regard. But when you look at in real terms, if I took away, what is this in exchange of? If I add 600 million rands to cabinet and add additional costs to the ministries, that is in effect a number of schools, a number of teaching posts, and that impacts on citizens. So it may seem negligible in a budget of 2.1 trillion, but we already have got such high levels of wasteful and fruitless expenditure within the broader fiscus anyways, that amounts such as these ones, unless you enumerate them and start to add them all up, you realize that in fact we are funding the state rather than using the state funds to help the people.
Let me pivot to something else in conclusion, and this is not something particularly new, but you have also spoken about appointing ministers from outside Parliament. What's your thinking? How would you ensure the best candidates are chosen, and what criteria would you prioritize?
Well, what I would certainly do is, in the constitutional provision given to the president in this regard, two critical areas become crucial. The one is obviously in education. I think we need to find the best individual who has dealt with education across the country. So my criteria would not only to look for, I'd look for the best education specialist around the country and bring them on board. And the second is security. I think that having politicians head up security in the country is problematic, not only from the perspective of them becoming corruptible in one instance, working with drug bosses, etc., which has been some of what our historical practice has been. But it means that from a crime intelligence point of view, they simply don't always know how to implement new models about how we can not only exercise a partnership with private security companies, but also learn from best practices internationally. So for me, I think that should be a position that's put up for someone who's independent, because then it's not used to police politicians. It is, or protecting politicians in certain instances, it is used effectively to fight crime. Those were two priority areas I'd look at, because they speak to development of a country and the safety of citizens in general, if you want to attract investment or any other developmental objectives you want.
Lest I misunderstand you, is this theoretical, or is this a vote of no confidence in the incumbents?
Well, for the current incumbents, it is too early to tell in some ways, but the numbers speak for themselves. I think that we've got to, at South Africans, without individualizing people, look at the real numbers. 80 people are being murdered every single day in this country. That is unacceptable. And we're going to continue in the wrong direction unless we do something radically different.
Musi Maimane, thank you very much indeed. Build One South Africa.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Still ahead on the program, the High Court has stopped the Durban Transnet Container Port Terminal 2 upgrade. amid a bitter legal dispute. I'm scheduled to talk to the chairman of the Transnet board in just a moment. But before we get there, the number of people drinking coffee daily is down 10% from last year, but half of all South Africans still start their day with a fresh brew. Consumer analytics and research company 8020 has done some investigation into the coffee habits of different demographics. Andrew Fulton is with us from the company. And let's start with prices, if we can. There's been a real surge here, over 20% for instant coffee, a little less, I think, for ground coffee. Maybe give us a sense of what's behind it and whether there is any relief ahead.
So, yeah, I mean, it was interesting for us. We thought for International Coffee Day, we would do something just packaging some data on coffee. And I was a bit surprised to see that, you know, we use the MAPS data set, which is put out by the MRF, 20,000 sample in a year. And what that says is the number of people who say they consume coffee on a daily basis is down 10% from last year, which surprised me. I mean, I couldn't drop my consumption by 10% if I tried. So we dug a bit deeper into the numbers and realized that coffee tops the list of largest inflationary increase over the past 12 months at 22.3%, which is astronomical. I mean, to put it in context, it's higher than eggs, it's higher than electricity, it's higher than anything, accommodation, anything you could think of that people are complaining about in terms of price increases. So yeah, quite a huge jump. And to be honest, a lot of it's, you know, Brazil produces 35% of all of our coffee, and they've had a really bad year with climate change and extreme weather. They've had extensive droughts, early frost. There's been supply chain disruptions around the world. Input costs have gone up in terms of fruit, fertilizers, fuel, and labor. And then there's currency fluctuations that we deal with as well, all coupled with an increase in demand of coming out of COVID. So, yeah, a kind of a perfect storm for coffee, as we're also seeing with chocolate. So two really interesting categories that are going on.
Andrew, let me bare my soul a little here. If there was a fire at my house and I either had to save Mrs. Maggs or the Nespresso machine, I would maybe weigh up the probabilities here. And the data that you've got shows that coffee pod consumption has dropped by over 30% in the past 12 years. Is this inflationary or are there other factors at play in the premium coffee segment?
Yeah, 12 months. So what's interesting there is all of the different categories of coffee had slightly different consumption changes. And once again, I mean, you know, as I know, survey data, it has its challenges. It serves a very good purpose, and it has its challenges. You know, this is people saying that they consume, and often recall isn't perfect. There's a number of non-sampling errors that can come into the data. But what we saw directionally, which I think is most important, instant coffee down, ground bean coffee up, and pod coffee even more down. And the inflation figures follow with that. So we've only got instant coffee and ground coffee, but the inflation for ground coffee was only 13.6. I think with the Nescafe, Nespresso, it's more around just people are downgrading their purchasing patterns because of what's happened with the economy. We see that, you know, people getting rid of their DSTV, people changing their medical aids to a kind of a more limited package, people getting rid of insurances. So I would blame it on that. And also, I mean, when we did some research, there's a pumpkin spice latte pod that sells 163 rand for a pack of 10, which makes it gram for gram 10 times the cost of instant coffee. So, you know, it's not a cheap way to get your coffee, Jeremy.
That is an eye-watering amount of money to pay for a little pot of coffee. As far as brands are concerned, Andrew, no real surprise here. Ricoffee, the clear favorite for nearly half of South African coffee drinkers.
Absolutely. If you can classify that as coffee, it's half of all coffee drinkers say Ricoffee. It outsells the next five. So it outsells, the next five combined. Jacobs Kroning, Frisco, Nescafe, Coffee Haze, and Douwe Egberts. I misspoke there. Not so much outsells, but the number of people who claim to drink it is the rest combined. So the other thing about survey data is it battles to bring in volume in a comparable way. So this really is looking at people who say they drink it.
Does this brand dominance tell us anything about consumer preference?
Yeah, I mean, South Africa is just a nation of brand dominance, isn't it? If you think about like Capitec and you think about DSTV and you think about, you know, Ricoffee, it just seems that there are some brands that have just really, people just are incredibly into and love and cherish. And yeah, for some strange reason, Ricoffee. And sorry, I'm being a little bit judgmental. I like my beans, my ground beans from El Salvador in a moka pot. But yeah, it's an important brand that a lot of people really, really enjoy.
Don't worry about it, Andrew. This is a safe space. It's fine. You can be as you can be as judgmental as you want. Did you?
Well, what I want to tell you is it was funny because you were saying about your wife. I mean, when I was asked, what am I going to do about this increasing price of coffee? It's like, I'm going to take it out of my kids' future. They're going to have to like find cheaper universities because I'm not going to cut back my coffee consumption.
Did you stir the spoon in any way regarding coffee shop consumption or behavior?
Yeah, so what's interesting there is there's only about 2 million people in South Africa who say that they drink ground bean coffee. It doesn't specify if that's in-house or out-of-house, but you know, it's not a large number of people, but you know, an adult population of 43 to 46 million people. So, and a quarter of those are in LSM 9 to 10. So it's kind of interesting that you see, I mean, it looks like you go to the Cape Town, every street corner is a bootlegger. There's Starbucks jumping up all over the place. We've had Vita for a good 20 years, as well as Seattle. So the brand map data, which looks at households over 10,000 a month, which fits into that LSM 9 to 10 category, they ask the question, which coffee shops do you plan to visit in the next year? Woolies, second year in a row, came up tops at 21%. Second this year in this survey was Starbucks. So it's moved up a couple of positions, kind of outpacing our local providers, Seattle and Vita.
And just finally then, a lot of data that you've given us tonight, is there any way in which coffee brands and retailers should be responding, do you think, to these emerging trends in coffee consumption, given that what I've learned is that price sensitivity is now a principle or a key factor?
Yeah, I mean, look, what is nice about it is that there are a number of different categories, a number of different ways you can consume your coffee. So, you know, one option is to move to a cheaper brand. Another option is to move to a cheaper category, like from ground to instant, if that's something you can do. There are a lot of options for consumers. I mean, that's the nice thing about our modern world is we're generally spoiled for choice. But I do think, given what's happening in the Middle East and some of the other news, we're in for we're not out of the woods. I was saying sort of 2-3 months ago, we've kind of like turned the corner and things are looking up, but things change rapidly in this planet these days, and I think we're in for some more inflationary pressure.
I'm looking forward to the next survey. Andrew Fulton, director at 80/20, always a pleasure talking to you.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, this story has been well documented. Problems at the Durban port and the interim interdict granted against Transnet's 11 billion rand deal with the International Container Terminal Services Incorporated has put a temporary stop to the much anticipated upgrade, the much needed upgrade of Container Terminal 2. Joining me on the program now is Andile Sanqu, who is chairman of the Transnet Board. Chair, welcome. Thank you very much for joining us. Maybe very quickly, tell us why the ICTSI was chosen as the preferred bidder.
Good morning. Good afternoon, Jeremy, and good afternoon to the listeners. We started a process as Transnet in February 2022, where we issued what you call is an RFQ, request for qualifications. And there were particular information that was requested for the bidders to supply. And upon consideration of that information, we then issued what we call a request for proposal, which was a formal request inviting interested bidders to just to detail what their proposal are to fulfill the requirements for a selection of a partner for the Durban Container Terminal Pier 2. And upon adjudicating that process, ICTSI became the preferred bidder.
Now, the losing bidder is arguing that ICTSI received special treatment in the bidding process. How do you respond to that, Chair?
I don't think so, to be honest with you. I mean, I have to be careful in the first instance to say that the amount of detail that I can provide in a matter that is before the court, I have to be sort of sensitive to that,
but and that's acknowledged.
In the main, though, Jeremy, the issue here is that we focused on the objective of ensuring that the winning bidder you know, achieves the solvency objective, or putting it differently, that we are able to satisfy ourselves that the bidder that would be the one that would be awarded meets the solvency requirements. And we do not believe that in the way in which we arrived at that decision, we would prejudice any party or had favored any party. That's the first point. However, maybe an independent court may arrive at a different conclusion from what we had arrived at as Transnet.
But, Chair, you are satisfied with the forensic due diligence process that was used to assess the winning bidder's financial capability?
That's correct. That's correct, Jeremy. Yeah.
Now, in terms of the Transnet recovery plan, you have said in the past, or have spoken in the past, about the urgency of upgrading the port's infrastructure and notably Container Terminal 2. This entire imbroglio then sends a negative message, surely, to potential private sector partners going forward. You must be worried about this.
Look, I mean, it's a disappointment, to be honest, but our commitment to work with the private sector to drive structural reform and introduce competition, and it's something that is a strategic objective for us. And as we have communicated very clearly in the past, that this has been informed by the limited capital that is available on our side to be able to upgrade our port facilities in the first instance, and to welcome competition. And three, we're very much mindful of the fact that we have lagged behind for many years in terms of investing and upgrading our infrastructure. And we are also behind, you know, with upgrading our technology. So in terms of our objectives, we're very clear and unwavering that we will have to partner with the private sector to do this. Of course, this was unexpected, and of course we are reflecting on this. But Jeremy, it's important also to understand that the our purview in terms of looking at the reform program is not only limited to ports. You have seen recently that we have announced the separation of the infrastructure company from the Transnet Freight Rail, where we are moving in earnest in terms of creating platforms for how the private sector can team up with us. And similarly, you know, on the TNPA side, we're busy with the corporatization of the of TNPA. So the broader reform agenda is on track, and it is well supported by the board. Of course, this is something that we'll sit back and reflect on and say maybe to the extent that we can make our process far more challengeable. I mean, I think it's a challenge that we'll obviously have to respond to in due course.
Let's talk about the reflective process that you're undergoing. As you wait for some sort of resolution here from the court, are there any contingency measures in place to make sure that the process is continuing in one way or another? Because, again, you'll want to give some sort of solace, I imagine, to people who use the services.
Of course, Jeremy, you're quite correct. I mean, you know, we are embarking, I mean, we have already ordered quite a number of port equipment as part of our fleet renewal program. And we started off a couple of months ago with the tugboats that we had we'd bought, and we are waiting for delivery of some of the cranes later this in November and some in the new year. And of course, I mean, this is whether or not we get the private sector on board or not, because we are very aware of the need to make sure that we upgrade, you know, our facilities. However, the significant capital that was going to be injected by whoever was a winning bidder would have given us a shot in the arm in terms of the momentum, you know, for driving this kind of a structural reform initiative.
And now that's not happening.
Well, it's delayed. Because I think it's important, Jeremy, to understand what the court judgment is. The judgment of the court is not to set aside the contract or the award of the bidder from ICTSI. What the court has done, it has interdicted Transnet from proceeding with the commercial negotiations. So this is part A of the process. Part B of the process will then be, I mean, the court, this is what the court has requested, that we must approach the judge president to find a date where we'll review the court application. I mean, you know, so that there will be an indication as to who then becomes the winning bidder and whether or not our processes are robust or not. That will probably take place in the new year. So to your point, whether or not is this not happening, our view is that this is a delay, and we are also expediting, you know, the process of ensuring that this hearing happens in, probably early in the new year.
I do appreciate your time. That is Andile Sangqu, who is chairman of the Transnet board.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now let's finish with this. It's a story involving a rugby legend, a business maverick, and a world-famous peninsula situated in the Garden Route. It's called Ballywood Property, and a Johannesburg-based property development company, along with Skalk Berger as director and Johan Rupert as an investor, facing a degree of opposition from an environmental group about plans to build a mixed-use housing estate on parts of the Robberg Peninsula near Plett. The peninsula, it's a World Heritage Site, contains Stone Age artifacts, and is at risk, say the critics, of being ecologically degraded and should be cut off from adjoining, or should it be cut off from adjoining wilderness areas. All of this according to the Robberg Coastal Corridor Protected Environment Management Group. I'm in conversation now with the chairperson, Dr. Morkel Pinnar, who joins me. And first of all, Dr. Pinnar, what's the main environmental concern here?
This application is emblematic, unfortunately, for many developments that are happening around Plettenberg Bay, in the greater Plettenberg Bay area. And this one happens to be directly adjoining us, and hence we directly involved, because once the planning permissions are sought, we get to comment on it. And obviously, it has an impact because of the increased density, what is at the moment pristine fynbos, and in the bottom section, they want to do more development, and then the top section of the property, the density of the development, you know, there's the access to the area, the availability of water. And then this is on a ridge, and all the runoff, all of these things go directly into the corridor. And this really narrows in places up to a couple of hundred meters. It's the only available lifeline that connects the Robert Peninsula to the greater Eden National Park, and from that to the corridor systems, especially with fynbos species. You know, there's some of these species of insects that won't fly over more than 50 meters of felt that is not fynbos. So if you get a development that cuts through a corridor like this for a few hundred meters, there's several species that are just permanently affected, and, you know, you get population islands genetically where inbreeding happens, right, where animals can't breed because mates don't come through.
Dr. Pinnar, maybe explain the significance to the uninitiated of the Robberg Peninsula as a World Heritage Site, and maybe just explain why it is so critical at this juncture to protect it.
Well, there's two aspects that really stand out. The one is the, you know, the biodiversity that we have on Robberg, and, you know, the coastal strip that makes up the largest part of the current protected environment. There's critically endangered types of fynbos that occur in this area. Robberg Peninsula being a World Heritage Site as well, there's evidence of ancient human settlement, and along a corridor, we've been finding more and more paleontological and archaeological sites of great significance that's being researched by international universities at the moment. All of these things are on, well, a lot of these things are new as well. You know, so any kind of development in a site where we don't know where all the archaeological sites are yet is a concern. I'm not saying that there's necessarily an archaeological site in this particular development, but the significance of the entire area is for this incredible ancient history that looks at, you know, really the origins of human culture in Africa, and where it developed between the areas here of Robberg Peninsula and Blombos Cave. And this is really the last little bit that still keeps all of these things attached to each other in its natural state, you know. So the small animals, the insects, and particularly the plant life. There's several regular species that occurs in this area. And with a development like this, the environmental impact studies haven't even been done yet. I mean, we're still in, obviously, the application process, and it's one of the things that we've objected to, is that you need to develop, we're not against development per se, it just has to be done, you know, with a awareness of the sense of place and fit in with that, because what makes Robben and this area so beautiful is the fynbos and the coastline and all these beautiful right. things. And then if it's just unchecked development, you just end up with a concrete jungle rather than fynbos.
Dr. Pinar, have you or do you have plans to reach out to the likes of Skalkberger and Johan Rupert?
Yeah, no, we have been in conversation with them. I mean, we just as an organization, our mission as the management team of a protected environment is to ensure the protection of that environment. So when we got notice from the municipality about the proposed development, we were invited to comment, and that's what we did. I mean, this is something that happens, unfortunately, quite frequently because of the number of developments. And the difficulty for an organization like us is it costs a lot of money to keep on doing these objections. You've got to, you know, do all the legal research and the town planners and everything every time. But if somebody doesn't object, then, you know, developments just go ahead and things get rezoned and replanned. You know, I don't think anybody has malicious intentions or anything like that. But if you don't know a history and the sense of the place, and it's not that there shouldn't be any development at all. It should just be done
right
in accordance to the available resources.
Are you satisfied with the response that you received from the two gentlemen I mentioned?
I haven't got a conclusion yet because the application process is still in process. So we're waiting to hear back from the, you know, the initial rounds of objections have gone in. And I believe we're waiting for some resubmission and submission of environmental impact studies and so on. But I mean, it would have been good with any situation like that to discuss things beforehand rather than to find out what's already in the offing, you know, because the objections are going to be the same. To us, it's not a personal thing. It's not the personalities involved. It's the principle of the development right on the border of a protected environment.
Do you feel that you're fighting a losing battle, that your voice inevitably is not going to be heard, that progress is going to trump the environment?
Well, I hope not. I can't say I believe that because then I'd be depressed all the time. But, I mean, it is a problem with habitat loss, particularly where we are at the moment, you know, in the world with climate change and environmental change and ecological collapse. You know, we've got very specific, highly endangered little areas of specific types of plants and things like that. And if you have unchecked development, certainly these things are going to be lost. I mean, there's less than 2% of Nijzenhof sandflower fynbos left in the world. So at some point, yes, we are going to find a better. I don't think, you know, it's not a matter of everything comes to a grinding halt overnight, but the long-term change as a result of this, then you end up with, you know, all these developments, and the reason everybody came here in the first place was the natural flora and the landscape, and that unfortunately would then no longer exist. Right. But that's where the role of protected environments like us come in to try and keep things conserved.
Dr. Morko Pinar, thank you very much indeed for talking to me today. And just before I leave you, on our last online poll, we spoke about warnings of a day zero water crisis in Johannesburg. 57% of our respondents saying that they are concerned. Just 7% say they're storing, and 36% saying we have been here before. On the poll today, is our GNU cabinet too bloated? That was the firm assertion from the leader of Build One South Africa, Musi Maimane. Well, do you think it's very bloated? Do you think it's the right size, or do you think it could lose a few pounds? If you have a view, please participate either on X or on LinkedIn. We'd be very grateful to hear your view. That's also our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.